So tonight I'd like to talk about the power of a certain kind of humility, a humility of perceptions, humility of views. And I'm going to start out with a story. It's based on a simile that many of you have probably heard. So you just sit back and kind of imagine yourself perhaps in a rural area. It could be ancient India, or it could be the heartland of this country, America. And it's an era where there's not a lot of entertainment that comes through. Pre-smartphone, pre-movies. And one of the highlights of the year is when a traveling magician comes through. And this traveling magician sets himself up at the crossroads or in a field or in a big tent. And each year, totally wows people. The subtlety, the drama, the power of his tricks, his magic. And perhaps you've been into this for several years or more. Then one year you go with this idea, I'm going to see how he does it. So instead of being in the audience, you find a way to maneuver yourself to kind of side stage or even backstage. And as the performance unfolds, you can see every little detail that helps him do his magic. The false bottoms to the boxes, the holes here, the color distortion there, all of it. You're seeing the same show, but you're seeing every little bit of illusion unveiled. At a certain point in the show, you're kind of bored maybe with seeing all this deception, this trickery, or maybe you're just curious, and perhaps turn your head and look at the audience. And they're completely enraptured. Everyone is just oohing and aahing and completely into the drama, the illusion. So while the tricks are just decohering, they're falling apart in front of your very eyes, the audience is enraptured. The performance ends, and trying to make your way out without being seen or having to talk to anyone, but a friend of yours catches you. And they were in the audience. And they just start going on and on about what a wonderful show it was. And they ask you, didn't you think that was a great show, great magic? And you're a little bit at a loss, perhaps, of what to say. Like, well, I wasn't pulled in really this time. One might say, like, oh, weren't you paying attention? Well, yeah, I was paying attention. And you don't want to ruin it for your friend, right? So they're like, well, how come? And I think the angle of view, I think where I was standing influenced my experience this time. So that story is inspired by Jnanananda, a bhikkhu, who adapted the simile of the magician in the Buddha's teachings. It kind of points to my three main points for tonight. First is that all subjective experience depends on the quality of our heart and mind, kind of like where we stand in relationship to that experience. The second is, since our hearts and minds interpret and construct experience, just like those magic tricks, humility and simplicity are really helpful dispositions to have when talking about what we see. And the third is that not clinging, not really taking a stand on concepts or views as the only valid truth, opens a doorway to peace, to exploration, to authenticity. So to start, this notion that all subjective experience is dependent on the quality of the mind, the where we stand that defines our relationship. This comes from my own insight, but it also comes from the very first chapter, canto, poem in the Dhammapada. I'm reading here from a translation by Gil Fronstall. All experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. Speak or act with a corrupted mind, and suffering follows as the wagon wheel follows the hoof of the ox. All experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. Speak or act with a peaceful mind, and happiness follows like a never departing shadow. The Dhammapada verses there kind of underscore the importance, how the importance of a thing is usually registered in our minds or the minds of others, if we're speaking and acting, based on the impact on experience. Right? The impact on our experience is how we actually register what's happening. And it's why, if we think it's important, it feels important. Sometimes this is talked about in terms of what's pleasant or unpleasant or neither. We're drawn towards one, typically. The habitual response is to push away the unpleasant, pull towards the pleasant, and ignore the rest, right? The importance and reality of a thing is also based on this subjective interpretation of experience. So, say you're watching a football game or another kind of sport, and there's a really exciting play that's happening, but it's happening really close to the edge of the boundaries of the court or field. The call on whether or not that play is a score or a foul partially depends on the angle of view of the umpires before we had instant replay. And there are famous cases in sports history now, just dramatic moments where the winner or loser of, say, a swimming race or a marathon is called by the video replay. And it's not necessarily what people thought it was in the moment, right? Or it was too close to call, too close to call. So these subjective experiences depend on where we stand. And unfortunately, we don't have cameras recording an unbiased view in our own minds or most of our own conversations, right? I kind of wish I had a pause button sometimes or rewind, right? So this interpretation, this sort of virtual reality engine that we hold in our hearts and minds, interpret, even construct experience. And because of that, I find humility, simplicity to be very helpful dispositions, particularly if my views, my perceptions differ dramatically or importantly from someone else's, right? So before I unpack that a little bit more, just humility isn't a word we talk about all that often in Buddhism, though I think it's all through Buddhism, really. So I just want to name some. There are a number of Pali words that can be translated as humble or humbleness or humility that have some like sort of a word cloud of similar meanings. And I'm just going to talk through what some of those are. So one word, sagaravata or sagarava, also can mean respect or respectful. Another synonym is vinita or well-trained. And this comes up in conversation between the Buddha and his kind of arch nemesis in the ancient texts, the ancient stories and teachings, Mara, or the internal force of death or doubt, not internalized in the texts, I might add. And Mara came to the Buddha near the end of his life saying, you know, you're really old. It's time to die. Like, just, you know, shuffle off now. You're done. And the Buddha turned to Mara and said, actually, no, I'm not going to die until the Sangha is well-trained, enough to carry on my teachings for hundreds and hundreds of years. And he didn't actually say that, but he made it clear it was like a vast amount of time. And the word he used, this vinita, well-trained, is the synonym for humble, which I think is really beautiful. Another synonym has connotations of humility and service, or what my chaplaincy educator used to call the heart of service. Service to family, to society, to community, to cause, whatever. And then the last one, nicca mano, humble mind and heart, considered a virtue in a practitioner. So there are some of the sort of embedded in the language, some of the meanings. But why is humility important anyway? One reason is that greed, hatred, and delusion in the whole family of their relatives, from, you know, desire to lust, to irritation, to anger, all of them are constructors of a certain kind of thingification of reality. Concrete, making something concrete that might be flowing or mutable. They're especially good, these forces in our hearts and minds, at shoring up and making rigid errors in our perceptions, distortions in our perceptions, and fixed views. So this distortion, what's truly humbling, happens at the level of perception itself, right? So fear, for example, distorts. The classic Buddhist simile about this is mistaking a coiled rope for a coiled snake. Right? Not hard to do if it's dusky out and you happen to be walking. More contemporary version is, I know for me, and this is humbling to admit, if I'm in a fearful or anxious state about an interaction with someone and I receive an email from them, I can read that email and get it pretty darn wrong. I've learned never to hit send in that state because 2 hours later might go back to the same email. It's totally innocuous. But that mental filter of the fear evokes something entirely different, right? I'm sure none of you have ever had that experience, right? Yeah. Okay, I see a couple of laughs of recognition. Hatred, anger, rage. And I'm not talking about sort of a healthy queen anger here, but more of an anger with an edge to it, an agenda, a distortion. those, the teachings speak that of them making people, that we kind of can make people or whatever the object of anger is ugly in our minds. Like distorts even perhaps the physical perception of the person, of their voice, of their intentions, certainly. The teachings also talk about anger contorting our own faces to be ugly, I think is really interesting. And then greed or lust can distort in a totally different way. It's the illusion that if I just buy, eat, get that thing, person, relationship, it'll make me happy, like really happy, not just in the moment, but forever. Right? So most of us are biased towards noticing potential threats. And this can be extremely, extremely harmful. The bias against people who live in brown and black bodies has been extremely harmful for many of those people. That fear can result in absolutely terrible tragedy, unwarranted tragedy. But even rose-colored glasses, perceiving the world through a naive filter of optimism, can be kind of tricky, right? This is it's not a perfect example, but it's kind of a simple one. I remember at one point, you know, many of us sat some retreats over Zoom in the last few years. And my way of adapting to that was some of the walking meditations. I would go hiking in the nearby trail here. So I've ended up going hiking a lot more in that time than I did before. And I remember being in this very calm, sort of loving, lovely state, walking along, kind of moving kind of fast to get exercise. And at the first glance in this super like relaxed state, I saw what looked like a large stick or root across the trail. And it wasn't until my foot was less than 4 inches from this very large torpid rattlesnake that I realized that I should be stepping over it and not on it. Fortunately for both of us, I avoided it and we were both very calm. But you can imagine, it might have been a very different story if the perception hadn't shifted to accurate. Right. Ajahn Chah writes one of his similes. He's a great Thai forest tradition Buddhist teacher who's now passed away. Our heart, when it's at its normalcy, is like rainwater. It's clean water, clear, pure, normal. If we put green coloring in the water, yellow coloring in the water, the color of the water turns to green or turns to yellow. It's the same with our mind. When it meets an object it likes, it's happy. When it meets with an object it doesn't like, it gets murky and uncomfortable. Just like water that turns green when you add green coloring or yellow when you add yellow coloring. The mind, the heart, just keeps on changing its color. And since everything is mediated through the mind, that means our experience keeps changing tint too, all the time. That's a real trip, isn't it? Another piece of this. The importance of this perceptual, spiritual humility is that often people's experience of the exact same event are dramatically different. It depends on the view or theory they might hold going into it, preconceived notions, shall we say, the kind of input we receive, our conditioning, and the emotional tenor. Theory and view influence the act of perceiving so much that they can influence whether or not something is even taken in. So can instructions on what to attend to some of you, perhaps many of you, have any of you seen the video where the watcher is instructed very carefully to notice the number of times one team of players, white-shirted team, passes a ball to another team of players in colored shirts? Yeah, one, two, three, okay, several. Or you've heard this story. So it's a very focused attention. I watched this. I was in at the Harvard Summer Institute. This was well over a decade ago. And I very carefully counted the number of passes. I was confident I had it right. And then our facilitator asked, so how many passes? And people, you know, more or less were in a kind of a range. And they said, did anyone miss the number of passes or see anyone else, anything else? And one of the people raised their hands and said, well, I wasn't really tracking it. And she asked, why not? Well, I was distracted by the gorilla that came into the stage. There were people who did not believe there was a gorilla. And while it didn't happen in my class, I've heard that upon replaying the video, some people actually think the video is switched out. However, it really does happen. A person in a gorilla suit comes in. It is not subtle, folks. Front, center, stage, you know, kind of dances around, does a couple of moves, and then walks off again, saunters off, really. So what we think is important in a moment influences what we can even see, right? And then there's other kinds of shifts, like what kind of input is possible to take in. I'm confident you've all heard the parable of the blind man and the elephant. I'd like to offer a slightly different frame on that, which is, you know, the king invites, requests these blind men to come in to kind of an arena in his castle or on his castle grounds. And they are commanded by the king to, by touching this creature, tell him what kind of animal it is. And as the story goes, each one reports something different. You know, it's like a post, it's like a broom, it's like this, it's like a grain, wall of a granary. A lot of people focus on that because each of them, of course, has a partial understanding. Well, they're also kind of set up, if you think about it. The most powerful authority in the land is commanding them to give him an answer. I don't know about you, but I'd feel a little pressure under that situation. It's not like there was the opportunity to openly explore and collaborate. They were on command, right? If they felt pressure, most people tend not to bring out the best in them. When the audience, the arbiter, has life or death power, right? And then there is the shift in experience that happens somewhat less dramatically than having a sense blocked off completely and the pressure of an authority. I have elders in my life, really beloved elders who were in law enforcement. I mean, they retired probably 20 years ago, right? And in preparing for this Dharma talk, I was talking with them and asking them, you know, how did you handle it when you went to interview witnesses after, say, a bank robbery? And one of them said, well, you'll get 17 different witnesses and 19 different stories. This was before the days of video cams, right? And one of the reasons that she gave was that, especially, say, the bank teller, if their life is under threat, their capacity to accurately pull in information in that moment drops to almost nothing. Understandably, they're concerned with the gun in their face, right? And people will say completely different things about the situation based on where they were, how much threat they were under, what they noticed, all of it. The same elder praised the advent of video cams and body cameras, saying it had been a real advance in the field. So this feeling of threat, just, it doesn't encourage accurate perception, right? This feeling of threat can also happen in much more minor situations. The eight worldly vicissitudes, pleasure and pain, loss and gain, praise and blame, reputation and disrepute. Those can feel, some of those, especially the last two, like existential threats sometimes. Right? So to watch, practice humility when that feeling of the identity is at stake, something very important is going on, like, to notice that's there. And it might be important to be accurate or set the story straight. It might be very important. And it's amazing how much more harmoniously and mutually satisfyingly things can unfold if I'm able to bring a little interest to a hot situation. Curiosity, openness. How do you see it? How come they think that way? As one of my professors once said. He actually said it a lot, more than once. So this is especially helpful when in disagreement with other people, whether they be colleagues, friends and family, fellow citizens of our country, whatever. And the ability to kind of set down or step away from the need for my identity being a certain way or for status or to be right opens up the possibility of an alternate lens. And that lens is perhaps one of them could be a functional one. This is the lens the Buddha often brought to situations in early Buddhism, the brilliance of the teachings. What decreases suffering in this moment? What aligns with an honest simplicity of what is arising right now? Not my story about it, not my view about it, but, oh, I'm sitting in a room with another person and my heart rate is pounding. I'm feeling the need to say more. So, earlier, I said humility and simplicity when interpreting experience can be really powerful. So what's so helpful about simplicity? So I'm talking here about a certain kind of simplicity, a simplicity of the heart and of the mind. Not necessarily, although it can be quite beautiful, simplicity of like lifestyle or whatnot. And I've found to be helpful about the simplicity that our mindfulness practice cultivates over time is it's not quite so easy anymore, though it happens on a regular basis, I'm just saying, to get taken in or led around by emotions, stories, views, mind states. The seductive power of stories is incredible. And the simplicity sometimes is just holding, oh, that's a story. The difference between story and reality is vast, right? So So it's a really supportive shift, I find, to notice when possible, and it isn't always, right? A thought is a thought. A story is a story. One of the first teachings I encountered in Buddhism was Pema Chodron, who sort of introduced the mantra in one of her books, "Are you sure?" I used to have that pasted to my bathroom window, or mirror, I mean. Say it every morning. Are you sure? Are you sure? So it's much easier too with this orientation to internal simplicity to set down or perhaps even avoid picking up that famous second arrow. You know, the first arrow is loss or blame. I just got blamed for something I did not do. That doesn't feel good to anybody, right? Nobody. Second arrow. Oh, if I'd only done it differently, it wouldn't have happened that way. Or, oh, what a terrible person that is. Or, oh, now my community thinks I'm an absolute jerk. Or, you know, on and on and on. It's so much easier and orienting to, oh, it feels bad to be blamed. Just, oh, resting with it. And the eight worldly vicissitudes, eight worldly winds can just blow through a little bit more easily that way. I can't remember who said this. It's a great quote. Much of enlightenment is learning how not to make things worse. Right. Yeah. So the simplicity of heart and mind, and I'm saying it's a whole lot easier to talk about than to do, or in this case, not do. It just lends itself to so much more of a restful, harmonious internal ecology, right? I don't have the quote, but I'm just going to paraphrase Ajahn Chah again. He talks about the simplicity and stillness of the mind in meditation, the mind at ease, at rest. Saying the mind can become like a still forest pool. All kinds of creatures can come there to drink, come and go. Fantastic, terrifying, unusual, beautiful. Shy. They just come and go, come and go. When the mind is able to be simple, still. This kind of simplicity is also kind of ascribed to fully enlightened beings in the early teachings. So an arhat or a Tathagata, a Buddha, so it doesn't stand upon the concepts created by the mind. The Pali is namanyati. This is Jnanananda's translation of the Sutta, the Kalaka Sutta. I'm just going to read a tiny bit here. Whatsoever is seen, heard, sensed, cognized, attained, sought after and pondered over by the mind. All of that do I know. This is the Buddha talking. Monks, whatever in the world, whatsoever is seen by the mind, known by the mind, I have fully understood. All of that is known to the Tathagata, but the Tathagata has not taken his stand upon it. Has not taken his stand upon it. In other words, he's seeing the magic trick from both perspectives at the same time. The power, the evocative power, the emotional power of illusion, and all the things that make it up, the simplicity of whatever event is arising and going away. Our eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, mind. This is a very powerful experience available at times in quiet meditation. And it's truly humbling to consider that it is said to be the natural state of a fully awakened being, just like all the time, right? So not clinging to conceptions and views, not standing upon them, protecting them as the only valid truth, invites this kind of peace and exploration and authenticity for the rest of us who are going to continue to stand on the shifting sands of our concepts and views and thoughts and rigidify them at times. It can be a really powerful way to sort of show up in debate or decision-making or group situations. To be open, right? To see those concepts as concepts, views as views. I've found it to be a really powerful protection in protecting me from multiple arrows when the world's not going my way, not so much, right? And instead of a need to be right or what feels pleasant, this can open us up to use wisdom as a compass instead. Buddha defines wisdom in a number of ways, but one is a form of that wise view, the orientation to what's causing suffering, what conditions suffering, what conditions the letting go of suffering. The Four Noble Truths, you know, seeing dukkha, the end of dukkha, the path to the end of dukkha. And the Buddhist teachings define a wise person, that compass is oriented to benefit from oneself, others, self and others, and all concerned, the bigger picture. So any subjective experience, when that's the orientation, can be fuel for further freeing the heart. How I meet and metabolize the slings and arrows of life can lay these wholesome conditions for healing, for growth, for wisdom, for connection. Other times, arrows of Mara can even just transform into understanding in the moment. Or maybe transform after a lot of composting later, right? That is a completely different kind of transformation than the illusion of that magic show. So I think that's enough. Thank you for your kind attention. And we have just a few minutes. If anyone has questions or comments, got like 3 or 4 minutes, I think, to chat.
I just want to say thank you. That was fabulous and so helpful in resolving. And I loved the story. I'm going to remember the story. I'm going to repeat the story. It's fabulous. And I was actually ranting in my head for a few minutes earlier today, and I caught myself, thankfully, and I said, ooh, old, repetitive. Do I want to keep doing that? And then some flicker of, I don't know what, intelligence or practice or just some blessing flickered in my head. And I said, I don't even know if that's the whole truth. You know, I'm just repeating this scenario. It got triggered because somebody contacted me with something recently, and it just triggered an old thing. And I thought, wow, I don't even know if that's the whole story, if that's the whole truth. I don't know what else is happening. So bless you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Really, really grateful. It was great. Thanks.
Thank you, Deborah. You're pointing to something that's so important, which is that wisdom. Wisdom and understanding doesn't mean total knowledge. It usually means the opposite. It's the humility to say, are you sure? Oh, I don't have the whole picture, right? Because none of us do. Pretty much ever, really.
Oh, I also love the use of the word humility, and I don't have any negative associations with that myself personally. I just think it's smart not to be arrogant. To me, like the maybe just given my background or whatever, the opposite of humility is arrogance, and I don't want to live there. And I always think that's comes from fear too, arrogance and, you know, lack of information. But anyway, this was just bathing in wonder. Thank you. Thank you.
Kind words. We have 1 minute left if anybody has a quick question.
I just want to say thanks too. I think you have some wonderful concepts that just will help as a kind of a prod to my practice, just simply remembering humility and simplicity, you know, and that how you say it, our experience depends on the quality of our heart and mind, and just to be able to set my mind that way and not to stand on concepts. Wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you, Barbara. Beautiful.